It's a privilege to welcome Joyce Strickland. We've been friends for a long time. Joyce and AD have been parents to many and given a home to many children. After they had Darren and Jana, who now have children of their own and give Joyce and AD grandchildren, they opened their home to many foster children, some of those they adopted. Joyce has mentored many foster mothers, and she has also given support to mothers of children who are in prison. So we welcome Joyce today to share stories and inspiration. And after the service is over, she will be at the door for you to speak to her. Thank you, Joyce.
Good morning. Well, this is something new for me. I've been a bit of a hermit since my son went to prison. Been a recluse and communicated with people all over the world. But it's a little bit different talking to people face-to-face than it is over the computer or over the telephone. So I'm stepping out today to share the story, my family's story, and the story of many other families throughout the U.S. Right now, there are 2.5 million men and women in prisons in the United States. And each one of these people has a family that is touched. And the thing is, these families, I found out, many, many are just like you and I. Many of them, there's no difference really in our families except for the fact that a child has gone to prison. So this morning, I'm going to share this painful story that my family has gone through. And what I've found in my life is that sometimes it's the most painful things in your life that give you the passion to do something you would not otherwise never do. And it started when I was 15 and my mother was killed by a drunk driver who didn't have a license, was driving down the street in front of our house and hit my mother and father. My mother was killed and my father had some brain injury. Kind of turned my sisters and my life upside down. We were shuffled around to family members, sometimes in the care of our father, which really pretty much meant we were on our own. But out of that suffering, God taught me some very valuable lessons. And it didn't take me long to realize that the lessons did come from the situation. I learned a real empathy for children that were in situations that were painful. And never a doubt in my mind that AD and my taking in all these foster children wasn't as a result of my losing my mother. And I also learned forgiveness. I carried around some real anger for the first couple years after my mother's death. Anger at the person that had killed my mother, and anger at a few family members that made life harder for us, that didn't see the pain and suffering my sister were going through. But once I forgave the woman that had killed my mother and the family members, there was just a huge burden lifted off of my shoulders. And it was a lesson that I've never forgotten. You know, that anger and not forgiving people drags you down, makes you incapable of helping others. So I'm also, another thing I've learned is that out of pain comes a real passion. And we can have concern and compassion, but sometimes it's the passion that comes from this pain that gives you the strength to do things you never thought you could do. November the 25th of 2007 was 2 days after Thanksgiving. Our house was full of family. Jana and her family had come up. Ryan and AJ were there in the house, our two youngest children. And we saw hope in our future. We saw situations that looked like they were going to be resolved with our son. And we were looking for help, and we thought in the right places. And we could see answers to prayer. And when we went to bed that night, we thought, you know, we were happy. We thought we would wake up the next morning and enjoy more family time. But a couple hours after we went to bed, our youngest daughter ran downstairs to where her dad and I were sleeping, and with terror in her voice said, "Mom, Dad, wake up. There are policemen in our living room." I grabbed my robe and ran upstairs, and sure enough, there was a SWAT team in our living room with big guns drawn. And they told me that our son had been involved in a crime, and there had been a shooting, and they were looking for him. I can't describe where my mind went, the panic. AD came up about that time. Our house was searched from top to bottom. That was just the start of our nightmare. Our son was on the run. We didn't know where he was. When friends would stop by the house to visit us, they were often followed by the police. On one occasion, our daughter was brought home, and the young man, who didn't even know our son, was followed to his apartment. He was thrown down in the middle of the parking lot and searched. His car was searched. His apartment was searched. It was just one thing after another. Ryan and AJ's mother had a good job at the hospital. She was asked to leave because people were afraid that maybe they would be in danger because of what had happened to our son. One day, there was a knock on the door. I answered. I was there by myself. Police officers marched in, sat me on the couch, wouldn't let me get up, searched the house, interrogated me. I gave them all the true answers, and they told me I was lying. They knew I couldn't be telling the truth. I had to know where my son was. They came at me, attacked me with their words. None of us who are honest and trying to do the right thing in our life think that will ever happen. During this time, it was hard to be awake. The thoughts that kept running through my head, you know, were awful. When I laid down to go to sleep, I couldn't sleep. If I did fall asleep, it was for a few minutes, and then I would jump up, my heart pounding, in a panic attack. I prayed and prayed, but I knew no matter how hard I prayed, nothing was ever going to be good again. I just knew that life would never be okay. It would never be okay for our son. All those dreams I as a mother had for him and his future would never come to pass. It was just nothing would ever be normal again. I finally found that the best way to sleep was to have a mantra. I would repeat over and over the 23rd Psalm and the Lord's Prayer. An hour or so of just repeating them, I'd finally go to sleep. A couple months after the crime, my grandson was born, Jordan's son. I was there at the hospital with the mother. I cut the cord, and we brought her and her son back to our house. Life was busy, but I was walking in a fog. I was doing what I had to do, but I was in a fog. When my son received a 103-year sentence, I was devastated. He has to serve 43 years of that 103 years. I knew I would never live to see him free. The pain, it never goes away. But I didn't see any hope of living a life that was at all happy, at all normal. But what I was to find was that God gives you a new normal when you go through a situation like that. God doesn't let you just stay in the pain and the sorrow and the devastation. God will give you a new normal. And He can use you because of what you've been through. Jordan was taken to a reception center in Powhatan, Virginia, where he was to be assigned the prison. He would start serving his term. I had gone down to visit him twice, got used to the routine, going through all those clanging gates, getting to the reception center, having to let them look in your mouth. If you have undergarments that have elastic, you have to pull them out and shake in case there's contraband. According to who is searching you, you can have a very personal areas of your body searched. You have to go through it if you want to see your loved one. This morning that I went, the third morning to visit him, I had talked to him the day before, and he knew I'd be there. After traveling almost 2 hours, I go in, go through the gates, get ready for the search, and I'm told he's no longer there. And they can't tell me where he went, that within about 2 weeks, he should have phone calls home, and we should know where he is. Well, he was my 18-year-old. He was my youngest son. And I, you know, how moms are. I panicked. I got home as soon as I could. Well, I missed part of the story. On the way back out all of those gates, tears rolling down my face, at the last gate there was a correctional officer, and he saw my tears. Sometimes you run into correctional officers that are very sympathetic, very kind, sometimes not. This one was kind. He saw my tears and he asked me what was the problem. And I told him my son had been moved. I had no idea where he was. And he told me, well, we're not supposed to tell you. He said, but there was a prison transport van that left in the early hours this morning for Wallace Ridge State Prison. So I ran home as fast as I could, got on my computer and looked up this prison. The first thing I found was a documentary about three deaths that had happened a couple years earlier to inmates that were over-tased. I read about the abuse that was discovered in the prison. Again, I was in a panic. I searched further and I found Prison Talk Online, which was a site for support of inmates and families, and an information site. I found the Virginia Forum, and I cried out, is there anybody who knows anything about Wallens Ridge or has a loved one there? And immediately a mother popped up, answered my questions, reassured me that the most horrible situations had been taken care of in the prison. Her son was there. He was doing okay. And she said, I will pray with you. I will answer any questions. And she gave me her phone number. Now, this is a complete stranger. But she reached out to me, and she gave me encouragement at a time when I was just at the bottom. Then she directed me to the parents' site. And there, 6 years ago, I met women who are still my friends. I found women who were hurting just like I was. There was a mother going through a trial with her son, and he got the death penalty. There were parents with their children in for a couple years. There were parents with children who had life without parole. We all had a connection. We were all there to support each other. And we prayed like crazy together. It became rather uncomfortable at one point because this prison site seemed to have problems with all the praying that was being done. They felt religion should not really come into it. We were more an information and support without all the praying and the talking of faith in God and all. So after about 2 years, first of all, my sister and I arranged for a couple villas in New Bern in North Carolina. And 16 moms of these prison moms joined us there. We had 5 fly in from California. They came from Florida, Ohio, Indiana, all over. We had never seen each other face to face, and we met, and we were just like sisters. Whatever our differences were, we had the one important thing in common, and we were there to support each other and support our children who were in prison. It was a wonderful week with lots of praying, lots of crying. We had one mother who was going through a trial with her son. He will get life without parole. Her 18-year-old son, just a month different in her and my son's age. They went to prison in the same month. And she was an emotional wreck when she got there. My shoulder stayed wet from her tears the whole time. But she gained strength, all of us did, from our prayers and our jokes and our laughing. And we'll be friends for life. Well, let me see. While we were there, one of the mothers said she would start a site, a group on Facebook. It would be more private than the other group. We could talk about, we could pray right there online. We could support each other and tell our deepest secrets without, you know, the whole world having access to what we were saying. There are now 100 members, about maybe 103 members in this group. Seems very intimate for as large as the group is. Some of the members are kind of chatty like me. I'm kind of the grandma in the group. I give advice, not always taken, but I give advice to some of these younger moms. But often the work is done kind of behind the scenes. There are a lot of mothers who feel their children's crimes are too horrible to even mention in that group. And so I do a lot of talking on the phone, chatting in private with these moms who are afraid even, in a group of other prison moms to tell their story. AD can tell you sometimes the phone rings way late at night. I've had suicidal mothers call. Mothers who resorted to alcohol to dull the pain call 2 or 3 in the morning, and I will sit up and talk them through the night and pray with them. One thing we found with our children was that mail is so important to inmates, having some human contact with the outside world. They can be so isolated, even, you know, in a prison with people all around them. They are taught to keep their thoughts, their feelings to themselves. You become vulnerable the closer you get to people, the more you let people know you. And so they can feel very alone, even in a very crowded situation. So when Jordan's birthday was coming up, I told the parents, I said, you know, I feel so helpless. I want to bake him a cake. I want to, you know, even birthday cards don't seem appropriate to send to him. AD has bought me a card program. And with this card program, I make appropriate cards for inmates. I found I can put little messages in them, put Bible verses in, change the wording up in the card, and personalize them for the inmates. The mothers, we started a birthday card group for all of our children. Then our children were so delighted with the mail they were getting, they started sending names of their cellmate or an inmate they knew never got mail. And so the list grew and grew. Finally, after the new Facebook project started, another foster mother and prison mother and I started what we call the Angel Heart card program. I'll give you an example. At Christmas, the 100 and some people that are in this group, and they come from all over the world. We have members in the group from the Netherlands, Australia, Japan, all over the U.S. We will each submit as many names as we want. For every name we submit, we send out 3 additional cards to an inmate that the others have submitted. At Christmas, we sent out, it was going up towards 2,000 cards. I don't tell AD how much I spend on stamps a month. I know he wouldn't say much, but it would bother him. What started out to just be a card project ended up being a pen pal project. When you get a response to the cards you've sent, you just feel so cruel if you don't respond. And the responses have been so great, so gratifying. And it's been so good for the mothers to take the focus off of your child and your pain, and to reach out to others heals you, as well as it helps the people you're reaching out to. For Father's Day, I made a card that I sent to almost 50 fathers in prison. In the card, I commented that I know how hard it is for parents in prison to be separated from their children. But there's a very powerful thing they can do as a parent, and that is, if they have communication with the child, to let the child know how much they love them. And even if they don't have communication with their child, they can pray. They can pray for their child, and that's very powerful. You wouldn't believe how many responses I got. AD can tell you, often the mail comes, and I have 10 letters in one day in the mail. And it's usually in response to my little chatty letters stuck in personalized cards. August the 4th is Friendship Day. There wasn't a holiday in August. So Friendship Day, I will be sending out probably 60 to 100 cards. And then having many, many letters to answer. I want to tell you just a little bit about two inmates who I never set out to befriend. I just sent a Christmas card to. This was the first year of Jordan's incarceration. I was scared to even send a card. You know, people say, well, what if they show up on your door? AD even said that. What if they show up on our doorstep? Well, I on purpose picked out three men that were serving. One was on death row in Ohio, and two were serving life without parole. I figured, okay, I'm safe. My family is safe. Well, I met, that first year, I met Brett. He was a 34-year-old man on Ohio's death row. I sent him a card, and he responded. I told him in the card that I had a son serving a 43-year sentence. His response was much more help to me than my Christmas card was to him. It was a 4-page letter, and he told me about his first days in prison. And he told me about how God had worked in his life since then. He'd been on death row for 12 years. And he told me, he said, stop worrying, Mama, just pray. He said, you can't change what is, except by prayer, and know that God has a purpose for your son, no matter where he is. He can use him. You have no idea what that meant to me, coming from a person on death row, how important that was. And through the next 4 years that I knew Brett, he continued to encourage me. His letters were funny, and they were serious. And he was serious about his relationship with God and how he treated other people. About 6 months after the first letter, he was up to be executed. I didn't know what to write, but I continued writing. His mother became very ill, which happens to a lot of inmate mothers. I know two right now, good friends of mine, who are battling cancer. Others have had heart attacks and strokes, stress-related diseases, illnesses are rampant among inmate families. his mother had a bleeding ulcer, and he asked me to communicate with her by phone, which I did. When his sister went to prison for a drug-related crime, he asked me to write to her. When somebody from his community ended up on death row there along with him, he said, "Would you please encourage him?" So I learned to know his friends. I learned to know his family. When he found out he had a daughter he had never known about, I contacted her. I was there with them through the process of him getting to know his daughter. This was 6 months before his execution. When he saw that his third execution date was set, he knew his chances of surviving that were very slim. And we started really communicating, talking about our deepest thoughts about God, about other people. He wanted to know more about AD and me and our foster children. He had been a foster child at one time. He wanted to know why I communicated with inmates and who I communicated with and why I seemed to choose the inmates that were the ones with mental issues or the ones that were truly alone in prison. He asked me if I would be present for the family visit the week before his execution. I had nothing to prepare me for that. And I thought, I can't do that. You know, how do you attend and this type of, you know, I'm so against the death penalty. And how do I participate in any way? I don't know what I'll do. I don't know what I'll say. But as the time drew nearer, I told AD, I've got to go. He wasn't real enthusiastic, but he supported me in my decision. I traveled to Ohio, stayed with an inmate mother, went to the family visit, which by death row standards was enormous. There were almost 50 people present. There was a Jewish rabbi, a Buddhist monk from Malaysia, Lutheran pastor of his mother's church. There were nuns. Many religions were represented there and had been special in his life. There were a few friends and his family. I spent that full day there with the family celebrating his life. We sang songs. We prayed. We had a good time in spite of the circumstances. The following 6 days, all but one, a friend and I went to sit with him and his family and his friends as they showed up. We could spend 8 hours a day in the deepest recesses of Ohio's death row. We were surrounded by cells. I ate prison food while I fed him from the vending machine. It was kind of a dare. You know, he thought I wouldn't do it, but I said, for my son's sake, I want to know what he's fed. It's not good. It's awful. You wouldn't believe what they can do to corn. And the meat doesn't resemble meat. It's bound to be soy. Some of it was pink. Some of it had green in it. It was awful. but I forced myself to eat most of it, at least taste everything on the plate. And you wouldn't believe the respect I get from inmates when they find out I did that for a week. When he was taken down to Lucasville, to where they execute their prisoners, he asked 10 people to follow him there. I was one of the 10 he asked to follow. I had become grandma to his daughter, the daughter he met 6 weeks before his death. I talked to her this morning online. You know, she's often granny. And she says that since she never knew her real grandmother, her dad's mother, I'm her granny now. And I can tell her about her father things that she didn't have a chance to learn. His sister, his aunt, who spent years as a missionary to Indians, American Indians, some of his religious, the people that he surrounded himself, and a couple friends and I were there. We saw him the night before his execution. We were taken in two by two to talk to him. We prayed. He gave the most amazing testimony about not showing anger towards the people that were doing these things, that were killing him. And, well, I see my time is getting away. I've got so much more to say. But it was a gift. It was a gift with nightmares involved to be there. And it was a very big gift, and I think God had his hand in it to teach me. There are other inmates. There's one, and I don't have time to really tell about the whole story. There's another one I met at the same time who had been in solitary for 12 years. No human contact at all. No visitors, no phone calls, no even sitting down with other inmates. No television, no radio. Nothing but a cell, taken out four times a week, twice to run circles in a cement enclosure with walls 15 feet high, twice for a shower. He had lost his mind pretty much. I sent him a card, got an answer back. It was written on used paper. He still uses used paper. I send him Sudokus, and he writes on the back and mails them back. I saw in this man a spirit to live, even though he had tried to commit suicide many times. He said human contact for me and a preacher's wife out in Kentucky had given him a reason to wake up in the morning and not wish for death. Just human contact. Somebody that cares. Somebody that's willing to listen. When I ask him, what can you do to change your situation to earn a radio so you don't have to just... He told me, he said, I've forgotten a lot of the words, but the melodies keep going around in my head. That's the music. So he said, if I could learn to keep my mouth shut when the guards tease me and pick at me. And I said, okay, next time you want to holler at the guards, write it in a letter to me. Use bad words if you want to. Just write it to me. And instead of being verbal with the guards, after 2 years, he now has a radio and a television. So, just a letter and a stamp and caring about somebody can make the biggest difference in their life. And prayer, always prayer. Once you have witnessed an injustice, you cannot claim ignorance as a defense for inaction. You make an ethical choice to act or not. I have no choice. I have to act. The statistics about prisons are astounding. In the U.S., we have 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of the world's prison population. One out of 31 adults in the United States are either in prison or under correctional control, which means probation or parole. One in 31 adults. The U.S. has 81,000 prisoners in prisons built totally for isolation. That's where year after year, decade after decade, prisoners are kept in a small cell about the size of the average bathroom with a cot and a toilet and a sink where the tank of our toilets would be. Some don't even have a little table or shelf to write on. Many, like the ones in isolation, have no radio, no television. Occasionally they might be given a book to read. They sit there and they wait to die. 81,000. Virginia has 1,800 in a prison 12 miles down from Jordan. And I believe there's one other prison. These are the level 6 prisons that are in total isolation. The prison where Jordan is has 25 cells for total isolation. Jordan spent some time in there, and after 3 months, he was not much the son I knew. He deteriorated that quickly. Imagine being there for 20, 30 years in a cell, no phone calls, no human contact. If you weren't crazy when you went in there, you would be crazy in no time. Prisons are big business. Private prisons are making big money. If you want to invest and have a good return, invest in private prisons. It's awful. They make their money by cutting services. Prisoners get no services. They get very, very poor food. People I know that work in prison kitchens say they often get meat that says not for human consumption. That's what prisoners are often fed. Majority of prisoners come from poverty, racial minority, family dysfunction, drug and alcohol abuse, have been offended by a child. Many of these men and women that I write to will tell me after they feel that they can really trust me about the abuse they suffered as a child, and many of them never told anybody that. Half of all people going into prison have a mental disorder. They don't get treatment for that in prison. Well, I'm going to stop there. There is more. But I do want to just take a moment to say, what can we do? What can we as individuals, as a church, as a community do to make it better? Charles Colson, I think most of you know who he is. He founded Prison Fellowship after his arrest and sentence following the Watergate crime. He urges Christians to support putting Bibles into prisons. There are programs that do, but they are not funded, and many of them can't at all meet the need. Support Bible studies in prisons. It's harder now than it used to be to get these studies in prison, but it makes the biggest difference. And I've seen with inmates that do have faith, it makes such a huge difference in their life and how they are when they come out of prison. Human contact through visits, phone calls, or pen pals can make a biggest difference. They need to know that just like each of us, their sins can be forgiven. They can be made whole through Christ. Faith-based programs need to be encouraged. The men that I've known that have been involved in faith-based programs do a whole lot better. They are much better equipped to come out and hit our streets and be in our communities. And as a church, if you have a job where you can employ somebody with a felony, most prisoners get out and they can't get jobs. They are often released. They don't have family. They don't have jobs. They have nowhere to live. That's a lot of the reason why they reoffend and go back in. There's just no way they can make it. Charles Colson has also said, if each church could reach out in the United States, could reach out to three inmates and their families in some small way, it would do a whole lot more than anything else, than new laws, than prison reform, just Christians reaching out to those in prison and to their families would make the biggest difference. There are some books that there's one, When I Lay My Isaac Down by Carol Kent, I believe her name is. The story of a mother, a woman who was very accomplished in her field and in working with her church. When her son went to prison with a life sentence, that is very good if you want to find out more. Dead Man Walking gives you a real insight into the death penalty. There's also a book I'm going to leave here where Conrad Brunk, George R. Brunk's son, collaborated on a book about restorative justice, which does a whole lot more than our justice where it's all punitive about punishment. So I would encourage you to read books that give you a little bit of an insight into this issue that so often we tend to think out of sight, out of mind. We don't have to be bothered by what's going on. So I encourage you to read one of those books. Thank you.